Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. I'm Alice, and I've got my co-host Dan here today. And we've also got a guest, Simon Lamb, who is the founder and CEO of Purposeful Change, a consultancy that supercharges company culture and helps leaders, teams, and organizations to thrive in times of change. Obviously, change is ubiquitous right now, so certainly must be helpful for many organizations. He's worked with some of the world's most valuable brands, Microsoft, Nike, and HSBC, to name a few. And through his work, has touched the lives of more than 500,000 people in more than 50 countries and in countless languages, I'm sure. So welcome, Simon. Thanks for being here with us.
It's great. Yeah, this is a great way to spend my afternoons.
Excellent. So we always start off by asking what our respective weird work moments of the week are. Mine this week was really, it's quite interesting. I had a project for a client. And as part of the engagement, had agreed to share it with some people in the market who all happened to be friends of mine. So I went out to a bunch of friends who I've known for years. And actually, full disclosure, Simon and I have known each other for about 10 years as well. Simon used to be my neighbor. So I went out to some friends with some feedback on some of the work I'd done with the purpose of feeding back to the organization what their reactions were. And actually, I realized how little I talk about my work with my friends. And so there was as much them responding to the work was also them responding to, oh, I didn't know you did this. And it's like, how long have we been friends for? So yeah, it just sort of made me think, do we all talk about work less often in our personal lives, or does it become less relevant at a certain point? I'm not sure. But that was my weird work moment of the week. Dan, how about you?
That's a really interesting point, actually. I wonder if it's a product of the past 5 years of, you know, work and life and everything being in like the household and blended so much that we're just like, now, nope. Keep them separate. I don't know. My weird work moment is I hosted a photo shoot at the company I'm working for part-time at the moment. We were doing headshots and, you know, culture working shots. And it's weird for everybody because you've got a professional photographer who's, you know, shooting all these people and everybody just goes on camera. And it's just a weird thing for everybody. And I'm there as the marketer trying to get everybody to relax. And then it's my turn to get behind the camera. And I just go and don't look anything like myself. So yeah, that was my weird moment.
Amazing. What about you, Simon?
My week is always weird. So I got so many to pick from. I mean, I'd work one-on-one and in cultures. It's interesting, as a friend of ours, joint friend of Alice's and ours, Claire, who said individuals are very rarely insane, but groups of people are often insane. And I work in culture, so I work around insanity a lot, I think. I think the first one was a person in a room where we were doing a kind of, what we do is a check-in at the beginning of a meeting. And the check-in is like about arriving and just saying, what are we feeling in this context? What's going on for us? What's the world like? What's our context right now? What distractions do we have? And this lady stood up and said, it's really inappropriate. You should ask those kind of questions to us because it's not psychologically safe in this team. I just need to declare that to you. To speak of those kinds of things or even speak up. In fact, it's impossible to speak up in this team. At which point I thought, well, I don't know how to respond to this, but you're speaking out in front of 50 people, which is the complete opposite of what you just said. So maybe there's some organizational myth going on here. And so I helped try to challenge her a little bit. And she was like, that's a really good point. I've just declared that something exists that doesn't exist for me. And so that was quite weird. And the second one I think I have to bring in was... We had 50 leaders from Microsoft we worked with a few months ago. And at the end of the session, we get them to write a letter to their future self. And then we post it to them like 6 months later. And this letter arrived and the husband of the lady who'd written it to herself, opened the letter and read this letter, which was, I wish for you happiness in your life. And he assumed that this person either had a stalker or had an affair. I spent the first 15 minutes of the call trying to balance out what, you know, the relationship with the husband and how she had the breach of trust and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, interesting. There you go.
That is a brilliant idea. I feel like we should all do that. Send letters to our future selves.
Then have to unravel the confusion at home.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Turns out she has had a stalker in the past. So that's what.
Okay.
So the husband was paranoid.
It was quite triggering. And then we also asked at the beginning of the podcast before, just to dive in, what are you where you thought you'd be at this point in your career? Where did you think you'd be and where are you today?
God, no, I'm nowhere near where I think either wanted to be or thought I would be. I don't think I ever had an idea of where I wanted to be. I think I was pretty confused as a, you know, I was an artist, I believe, in my life, but I went and followed my father's path, or what I thought was my father's path of academics. I mean, people say, how the hell did you get there? And when I answer it, I like, they say, don't tell me you don't know how. And the truth is, I have no idea really how. It's a kind of a weird set of accidents. And the more senior people I meet all the time, kind of is a common theme. It's like most people accidentally land where they land. It's very rare that it's like kind of a solid idea. But I can see the connections between my life. I actually wanted to be a lighting designer. I got there. Problem is, my first job was in theatre, and I kind of reached my dream job within the first 4 years of work. And so it's like, where do I go next?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that. They sort of realize where they think they wanted to go, and then once they get there, it's either not what they thought it was, or it's not as fulfilling as they expected it to be.
Well, I think this is a really great thought here, because I spend a lot of time with people, mainly women actually, redefining what the win or success looks like in middle age. Because what it looked like when they were young is very different to what it looks like today, but we don't pause and revisit what success looks like. And you're using really fancy, nice words like fulfillment. I think people have got success and fulfillment mixed up, and happiness. You know, and I think it's a real issue in the world, because people don't revisit what success looks like, and then they accidentally drive for something that doesn't fulfill them.
Yeah, I think there's also maybe for women, at least of my generation, when we were growing up, it was like you grow up, you get a job, you work in that job, you meet a husband, you have babies, and then the thinking sort of stops there. It's like, what happens after that? And actually, the bulk of your adult life happens after that moment. And so I think for us, we weren't really given the opportunity to sort of explore what midlife looked like for us, or what would make us happy at that point.
Yeah. I mean, I think I spend a lot of time with very senior women asking the question, who are you? And them not really knowing what that I would call it the kind of the age of lost identity. It's like I surrendered my own identity to the system, to others. And then comes a time when they become, or they're on the edge of being empty nesters. And it's like, I don't even know who I am. And I think we think that it sits around the period of menopause because it's biological. I think that's also true. But I think the timing happens to be at the time when people start leaving home as well. And I think that's like kind of, now's the chance for me to think about who I am. Yeah. And I think it happens for men too. I think the identity is different. I think I was coded, and I find, you know, I traveled around a lot of the boardrooms of some really big companies, of it speaking to executives who felt they had to sacrifice themselves to drive success for the win. Right. And then gave up their connection with the family, etc. And I think both, you know, both masculine and feminine have suffered in this world of where we feel like we have no choice. We kind of surrender our identity to either work or home, but not actually considering that actually you can have both.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting, somebody we interviewed a couple of weeks ago, and she is a coach for founders and entrepreneurs. And she was saying that it's quite common that men will say, well, you're going to hit a million, right? And she's like, well, that's not what success is to me, reaching a million. You know, that's actually not why I did this. And it's just that perception of, again, like you say, defining success. But we're hoping here to help people unpick, how do you actually figure out what that means, success, fulfillment, happiness, whatever that is. And, you know, the next chapter. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're playing to my third weird moment that I didn't name, which is a CEO of a major organization that you would know, standing in front of 500 people saying, my biggest insight out of today is that we're over-focusing on profit and the output, and actually it's the people and the input that matters. And I remember sitting in the room, at first happy and applauding it, and secondly, feeling the tragedy sink into my stomach, that how many hundreds of years is it going to take before we actually believe that the soft and fluffy is the really hard stuff. These are the skill, the people skills, the leadership skills around people, and living for fulfillment is the hard stuff.
I mean, what does great leadership look like to you today? I mean, if we think about what is obvious to all of us, which is this sort of VUCA perma-crisis kind of environment we find ourselves in. Obviously, the challenges of leadership are arguably greater than they've ever been. What kind of leadership skills is emerging in this context that are proving to be successful for big organizations?
Yeah, I think I'm preferring the, I don't like acronyms particularly, but the VUCA's been around for a while, but it's very out there. I kind of prefer Barney, which is brittle, anxious, non-linear, and incomprehensible. And that kind of talks about the inner game. And I think great leadership is that balance between the technical leadership that you need in order to get stuff done. You know, most leaders I find have been hired into this kind of profile of insecure overachiever, highly achievement orientated, worry about everything, right? And organizations love that kind of, they recruit and promote that. But that creates fear in the system. And that isn't the best way to run a system. We know that through studying culture. So I think there's a from towards. I'm not saying that, for example, authority isn't needed, because it's needed at times. But how do you balance? It's the tap dance between authority and empowerment that we hear about. It's the tap dance between being the expert, but also being able to explore and be in learning. It's that balance between, you know, being directive, but then at the next moment being a coach. It's the great leadership looks contextual to me, because we are facing, and I think this is true, and this is what we're working with. If you work in the large organizations in the world, the answers to the questions aren't apparent anymore. They used to be. I think we've kidded ourselves for decades. If you just look at some of the things that are at play, you know, like climate, like technology, and I'm working in the middle of an organization who is at the forefront of AI with Microsoft at the moment, the answers to the problems that the organizations face, they don't exist. So that means I can't be the person who knows it all, that gives direction, that drives through authority. So I need to learn how to explore, and leaders weren't coded that way.
How do you help to create cultures that surface that kind of more flexible, open sort of leadership that is needed to deal with that uncertainty?
Yeah, well, I talk about three things, really. I mean, it's bringing the individual and the systemic, the kind of cultural stuff together, but it really starts with awareness. The first thing is awareness of the impact that you have in the way that you lead, and awareness that you're even being reactive. I think part of the problem here is a lot of the leaders think that being driven is not a reactive state, and it is. You're driven, focused on the outcome, on the result, not the input that's going to create the quality of the result, if that makes any sense. And so it's that awareness, and then I think it's to help them build a sense of purpose. It's like, what does success look like? And how are we going to frame that in the context of where we are right now? What's meaningful for me, not just what is meaningful for my shareholders or the owners of the company or what I feel I have to do. What does fulfillment look like for me? So that awareness, that intention, and then discipline. The irony is people think that the soft and fluffy stuff is easy. It's not. We avoid it and we push it away because it takes incredible discipline to be able to discern. It's, you know, that Daniel Kahneman's thinking fast and slow. His, you know, system two thinking requires effort. It requires energy. And so then if I get underneath all of that, Alice, you and the thing you and I have talked about is, you know, this thing called well-being. It's not just a nice to have. If your system, if you don't manage your energy well, if you're not healthy in your own body system, family system, whatever social system that you're in, you can't be able to discern what type of leadership to use and how to bring yourself. Adaptive is probably the word I would use. Adaptive leadership is what's needed in the world right now.
So you and I have talked about some of those myths that we hold on to. Yeah. Within cultures and within our own working lives that prevent us from having that kind of adaptive leadership. What are some of those key myths that we hold on to at work that we need to unpick?
I mean, I've been talking about one of them, which is like the best way to get stuff done is through authority, right? And using misuse of fear. I think some leaders I've witnessed, when they get tired of trying to empower the organization, they just defer to parent, right? So the children won't play. I go, oh, let's have an adult conversation. And then when the children don't play, they go to parent, and the children go, told you were parent. And so they build fear into their system. And so understanding how to motivate and understand the inner motivations of your people, I think is critical. What's the underlying factor that's going to motivate people towards something? It's not provoke, it's invoke. evoke in others a behavior. And so, yeah, that overuse of fear, the myth is that that will get us anywhere, the short-termism, it doesn't work. Now, and that research goes all the way back to firms of endearment, good to great. You know, it's researched. It's like, we know it's got empirical evidence. I think the other one is this idea, the idea of individualism that's everywhere. You know, I need to look after my own stuff. I need to, you know, protect myself, when actually interdependence is the part. So in order not to be dependent in the system and not to be, I build for independence, you know, and this whole kind of self-importance comes out as people fight their way up the organization. And then they start to fight between each other. And actually, we're all interdependent.
Right. They're,
of the hierarchy, I generally try and help leaders invert the hierarchy, that the system isn't in service of you. The system is in service of your customer and the output. And you as a leader are in service of enabling the rest of the system. Invert your pyramid. So you're not the important one. And the problem, I think, as well in that is that a lot of leaders get to the senior level of organizations because they have the seniority is a proxy for love or care or something that was missing in their life. I mean, there are a couple.
Alice and I had a chat a few weeks ago, and going back to your point around fear, we both relayed moments of managers we've experienced, and I broke out in hives just relaying the story. I could feel the moment that something that happened 7 years ago, you know, could be even longer, and we could feel it. And everybody's probably been in that situation where we've had, you know, somebody do that to us. And I've always prided myself, like, my God, I hope I've never done that to anybody and never want to. But those things that you've then touched on, where as a manager, somebody, a manager or a leader, maybe listening to this podcast and thinking, shit, well, where the hell do I start on this?
Well, you know, I think it all starts with me, and it starts with myself and understanding the impact that I have for this. You know, I've worked so many times in how do you build a feedback culture in organizations? It's really, really simple. Ask for it. As a leader, ask feedback. Don't go and tell people feedback. Stop all of this training in how to give feedback. It's like, yeah, there are methods. It's a great skill. But you create a feedback culture by yourself as a leader, role modeling, asking for it, and then responding. The second part is responding to it. So it's that awareness. It's that willingness to explore, the willingness to press pause and get out of the day. I think that's the other thing. Time, this myth about time, it's your relationship with it. You have to press pause in order to zoom out on life and look at what's going on here, what's working well and what's not working well, and how am I part of the not working well, even if I want to point the finger at other people. Those leaders who reflect on their impact in the world and own their own part in the dynamic of whatever's going on, they tend to be the ones that I see succeeding, because that seems like humility. I think we've also mixed up this idea of humility and vulnerability being, I need to just tell my life story and cry on stage, whereas actually the most humble moments, the most vulnerable moments are a senior leader asking their team for help. I don't have the answers.
What important lessons have you learned as a leader of organisations and of people yourself?
Overplayed care can lead to highly destructive behaviour. I know a lot of leaders, you know, maybe listening to this is thinking, oh yeah, but I really care, Simon. It's not that I don't, I'm just driving for success, I care, but sometimes our overplayed care is a part of the problem as well. So we'll focus on outputs and we'll care. And my overplayed care caused me to, in a couple of instances, not give people feedback that they needed to develop. And then they ended up, I look back years later, the system rejected them. It doesn't help. It's the having the courage to name the things that need naming. It's the biggest lesson is that lesson of avoidance of the, and people talk about it, the difficult conversations. The problem is we make them difficult in our head. And then we end up being part of the problem, and then we end up spiraling into not feeling fulfilled in the workplace. And so, like, it just all leads to unhappiness. The biggest lesson I learned was that idea that being honest with someone, or honesty is about being honest with someone, but also being able to receive honesty back, to be honest with yourself, that you've only just got a perspective. To be able to have those dialogues that you might not have normally because you're fearful. So stepping through that fear of, you know, whatever you might imagine to be true, to say the very thing and see what might be on the other side of it, I think is most important.
And that's really difficult. So I had some coaching last year as a part of a leadership team, and we role played out some feedback that we needed to give to each other. And one person would say it, and then the other person would say what they heard. And that was just a really good exercise because I was like, what was it you were trying to say there? And they said it really bullet point when we were out of the role play. I was saying this, this, and this. I was like, actually, you've just told me X, Y, and Z. They're two different things. And then we'd write it down. Again, these are simple things. I'm not trying to teach anyone to suck eggs, but writing down what you want to say, because then is it really, really clear? Because then that feedback moment can bring on things like nerves and things like that. And just there's the whole thing around the shit sandwich. Don't go in with you're amazing at this, negative feedback, or you're really good at this, because people hear the good stuff. Like that's,
Sorry,
they'll,
yesterday.
yeah,
I'm sorry,
they are.
yesterday. This piece of feedback said, well, my first piece of feedback for you would be for this person would be they're an amazing human being. But when they dominate, they completely take over. But I know they're well intended. Yeah, it's helping.
Yeah, the constructive feedback's gone. One of my greatest managers in my whole career, he used to do it so simply, and he'd be like, "Dan, right, here's the great stuff. Tick, 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 and let them off. Here's the learnings and the things for me to work on. Da, 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 da." And then we'd explore those things. Right, how are you going to do that? And really coached it through. There was no, I was there for the feedback because I wanted it, but we've almost got muddled, I think, with how to really, really do that. And I'm sure that's a whole podcast episode by itself, But yeah.
There's so many things that you've just said, Simon, that have triggered all sorts of thoughts for me. But one thing I wanted to return to was your comment about individualism. I think particularly as younger generations coming into the workforce are maybe less trusting of the institutions and organizations that they are going to work for, or that social contract has been broken to some extent where they don't have the expectation of that organization looking after them over the long term. It almost feels like there would be a shift towards a greater sense of individualism in so much as I'm going to build the career I want to, or I'm going to have a side hustle, or I'm going to just do this, that, and the other, move around and start a business, whatever it is, that actually suggests that maybe that individualism is becoming a greater feature of that generation as opposed to a lesser one as we learn and evolve and figure out how we work well in organizations. And I guess I'm wondering what your thinking is on that. And does this actually generally beg the question of what is the purpose of the organization? And how do organizations convince younger people that they are a force for good, and being part of them is something that will, that is an important part of work these days?
I mean, there's so much in there, right? Like, well, I mean, the trigger in me is, well, why would you trust in the system right now, given all the messages the system gives out? I mean, maybe there's an intelligence in that generation that wasn't in my generation. Maybe we blindly trusted the system, and actually now's a time to start to challenge that system. We're certainly seeing the polarization in life. There's a lot of, I mean, my heart tells me I want to bring people together, and why are we so separated? But the collapse of the system won't happen until we separate. My fear is that we actually have to separate further before the system collapses because we're in right versus wrong. So anyway, that's a whole, I mean, that's a month of podcast in there. For the institutions, do we inherently trust them? Well, they're legal entities and they're pieces of paper. They don't exist without people. So then you talk about the purpose of the organization. I mean, if you go back to what Drucker did say, Drucker actually didn't say culture strategy for breakfast. He actually did say, though, profit is the oxygen of organizational systems. And at the moment in our monetary system, money is the core purpose of most stock-owned organizations because the pension schemes that are investing want their money out. And I see it every time. I see it all the time. CEOs of organizations, for me, it's the and. So unless leaders start to embrace their system's role in the system that they exist, then I'm going to say I'd endorse Generation Z's perspective. It's up to the leaders of our systems to recognize that there is a role to play, that you don't just take the money out of the system, that you actually serve the ecosystem or your ecosystemic on the planet. And that means you need to consider planetary conditions, i.e. social context, i.e. environment, i.e. all of those things. And you're responsible for that. I mean, we used to bow at the altars of churches, and I know religion is still pretty big around most of the rest of the planet, but the UK it's much less. I think we actually bow at the altars of the big corporates of Apple and all of those, and we're unconsciously colluding with organizations that do huge damage in the world. I mean, just look at our phones. With me, I've done a video on Democratic Republic of Congo, and then my, you know, these things that we have here, this computer that we're working on, you know, the minerals that have built it come from conflict minerals. 1,700 people a day, men, women, and children, are raped in the Democratic Republic of Congo because of the organizational systems that we buy from. Like, sorry to take us to a dark place, but the reality is the skepticism, or at least cynicism at worst, you know, may be a helpful factor. What does give me hope, so to grab hope out of this, is I do see many, many, many leaders really wanting to change, but it's hard. People think it's up to the CEO. It's the boards that control. The people don't realize. They think they get to CEO level and then that's it. They're free. I fear that what I see in board level roles is that they're caught in between the shareholders, the owners putting pressure. The amount of people I work in private equity or stock-owned systems that don't have any freedom whatsoever, and are forced to make decisions that drive fear through their system. I don't know. It's hard.
It's good to hear your perspective on organizations in general, because obviously you are out there every day fighting the good fight to make them more purposeful, more responsible to the people that they serve. And I'm sure you must have moments of questioning, is it all going in the right direction generally, or am I just doing what I can?
Oh, there's a guy called Otto Sharma, who we have indirectly worked with for decades, and a dear friend of mine, Vanessa, and we partnered with him while I was at HSBC. And one of his questions was, you know, when I'm working with you, am I just helping you sharpen the tools of the system? You know, it's a very good question. Have I helped lots of people, supported people in their own sense of well-being? Yes. Have I shifted the system? It's a question I ask myself every single day, every day. And I'm skeptical as to sometimes my own power. In fact, you said you work in organizations making systems. I think what I've surrendered to in my last 3 or 4 years, turning 50, I think, was it's not my job to make them. In fact, I'm here to support others to do that because they're the people in the power. Any idea that I'm attached to that will actually cause me not to do the job, if that makes any sense. Becomes a personal crusade.
I mean, just thinking a bit broadly about the direction it feels like leadership has been going, it's been messaging from Brené Brown and conversations about vulnerable leadership, which you mentioned earlier, reintroduction of empathy into leadership roles, that sort of thing. We've seen quite a lot of conversation about that, say, over the last 5 to 10 years. And yet what it feels like at this particular moment in time, and granted, it probably feels more sharpened because of we're now at the end of January, the last few weeks of activity coming out of the American political system, do you feel like we're going to see a shift away from some of those things? Does it matter? Is it important? Is there a nice somewhere in the middle that we should be heading? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I think the individuals, you know, that you're talking about pushing political messages out are not representative of all the leaders of organizations that I meet. So I think we have to be careful, because what we do is we tend to watch the news and take the news, as the information from the news, as being reality. However shocking it is, the truth is, even under the last administration, there was huge amounts of damage done, right, and reported back. And yet the lives of many didn't really, you know, the day-to-day life of people didn't really change that much. And so I think the answer to that question is, how do we more broadly empower the masses to get... I don't hear people coming to work saying, you know, I want less fulfillment. I want to work harder. I want to feel like I'm the subject of I'm a servant of this system. I don't hear people saying that. I hear people, and like you say, Generation Z, asking for their rights, their needs to be met. And I'm seeing organizations shift towards that. So, you know, it's a fine balance. I guess the question is whether employees are willing to not just wait for this thing to happen, to ask for it. And so continuing to complete those employee surveys that are requesting it, because every organization I know are measuring their leaders on what their employees are saying. So there has been a significant shift. We used to measure leaders on P&L. We then saw that employee engagement drives better P&L, so we started to measure employee engagement. We then realized, well, we need to go a bit further than that, because there's culture that drives employee engagement, so we need to shift on that. So I think that, let's not deny, there's been a massive shift. If I look at my early career to today, very different world.
Tell us what the early days were like. What are the real standout differences?
Brutal. Yeah, I mean, I was an asset. It was brutal. My wife says it sometimes, even about if you think about our own organization, like my son, Harvey, will probably listen to this and kick me under the table about why I say this. But, you know, my wife, Monica, will say, God, they just haven't got experience of working in that environment. And I said, like, do you want them to? They don't even know what work is. You know, those kind of comments that come from 50-year-olds, right? You know, haven't got a clue what work was like our parents said. And it was brutal. You didn't have a voice. You did what you were told. Otherwise, you know, I remember in a consulting environment being in a room and we created this, we called it a horse blanket. So it was this thing that did the presentation for the client. And the VP walked in. One VP would walk in and say, no, that's all completely wrong. And the next VP would go, no, I need you to put it back to where it was. And then the next VP would walk in and go, that's completely wrong again. And so you get stuck in the middle. But you feel like you had no voice. And I remember one coming in and just ripping up every single piece of paper and screaming at the top of her voice. She was a very small person who's had huge volume in the world and scared the crap out of me. And I don't see that as, I mean, it's happening. It's happening out there. But in the environments I'm working in, that's not as acceptable as it was back then. And that was the norm for me. I think Gen Z are inspiring up, actually, and I think we miss this often, is that we can be inspired by the younger generation. And I think some of the older generation are going, well, I'm going to name it with me, right? So the first thing with me, you can see my glasses, like a bit of colour. I have sparkly shoes, not on today, but I normally wear sparkly shoes. Both ends are quite interesting, boring in the middle. And I've been desperate for years. I've got a theatre background. I'm very open. I'm quite connected to the feminine. 90% of my coaches are women for some reason. Don't know how I ended up with that. I think I'm a bit of an ally. I'm a greater balance for feminine energy in the workplace. Not just a balance of gender, but of that. Now, you know, I want to paint my nails some days. Monica freaks out when I say my wife. It's like, why would you want to paint your nails? Because you can. Why can't I? And that's kind of an expression. I like to express myself through colour. And so I think that what I'm saying there is, I'm now wearing sparkly boots. Sometimes I'll wear something like that wouldn't be what a man would have worn. I was known at one of the banks I worked in. One day I accidentally turned up in a bunch of Lululemon clothes because I'd left my suit in Copenhagen and I ended up in Stockholm without it. Went on stage in front of 300 bankers, all of whom were in blue suits and ties, and I was in my Lululemon kit. And I said, I apologize in front of them. Look, the first rule of change is look like the enemy. And the CEO walked up to me and hugged me in front of everyone and said, no, we like you because you provoke by being different. By the way, that after that, the CEO hugs. That was the thing that said afterwards, he hugs. I'm like, he's got five kids. Of course he hugs. Anyway, back to the point is I've kind of been inspired to want some of the things that they are demanding. And I think I'm seeing that. I'm seeing that is like, hold it. Happiness is a real thing. I think we're talking the language of fulfillment here, which is right on the mark. Because I think there's a distinction between happiness and fulfillment. Happiness is this like harmony idea that it can always be good. Whereas fulfillment means it can be really tough, but I feel something fulfilling from that. Life's a sine wave of hard and good and easy and, you know, it's highs and lows. Fulfillment is what I get out of it. And a lot of those people are saying, so what is purpose? What is my purpose? We get born into our systems. We get coded by our systems. And in those codes are that you must succeed in order to get mother's love, father's love. I hate to take it back to early psychology, but it's true. And you can't hide those patterns in the workplace. And so, you know, we were taught to be successful by the previous generation in order to protect us. But actually, we get to later life and realize, do you know what? To quote Alan Watts, you know, we realize that we've been treating life as a journey with some destination in mind that is, you know, money or retirement or heaven or whatever that is. And actually, we forgot that the whole point was to enjoy life as we went, to dance and play. And I think people are realizing that.
Absolutely. I think that the feminine masculine thing is really interesting. I know, Simon, you and I have had some conversations about this in the past as well. I hate to keep bringing everything back to U.S. politics, but it's very much front of my mind right now. Zuckerberg coming out and saying we need more masculine in our organizations. We need a return of the masculine to the workplace. What do you think he means? And what are your thoughts?
I have no clue what he means. And I have no allegiance with that point of view on any level. Do I believe that in organizations we've got a misunderstanding of what psychological safety means? Yes. Does it mean let's man up and get more masculine? No, I don't think that's true. All of the research tells us that the core of high performance is a psychologically safe environment, and the balance between masculine and feminine, in my mind, brings that, or in my experience, from my mind. We need to balance between the masculine and feminine in the workplace to do that. And the problem is that there have been, and you know, we see it, I saw it the other day in one of the systems I was working in. It's like psychological safety is now weaponized. Just like growth mindset was weaponized, and I know Carol Dweck rewrote her book on growth mindset is not about having a growth mindset. Growth mindset is about owning your own fixed mindset, right? These things get weaponized. Psychological safety has been weaponized to, you're not making me feel safe. You're not making me, this isn't a safe environment. Now, that at one level is true, but there's a paradoxical opposite that's also true, which is psychological safety is also about being comfortable in the discomfort. And so if we suddenly go to this man-up environment where we don't speak about any of those things, people will withhold information. And in the context of needing the information and the input in order to answer the biggest complex questions in the world, then we need to create environments where people are going to bring their perspective. So, you know, the idea that we go to this more masculine world, I don't get it, because my sense of the masculine roots of today and the silence in the root of the men, or the line of men that I stand behind, who never name their needs, the biggest struggle I've had came from the war. These men were silently pushed to war and had to come silently back and hide and not speak of the atrocities that they committed or saw in front of them. And that built this silence into men. And I think there's a big contributing factor of the wars that we have behind us, Civil War, World War II. And the men were the ones, the majority were the ones that went to the front line in those days. And not the same now, but we're still coded by that history. And if we stay in silence, we cannot answer the most complex questions on the planet. So it's just like, no, doesn't work. I mean, my skeptical self says that's just alignment with a political being. And so I'll say the things that the politician needs me to say so that I stay online and don't get hammered. You know, let's be clear. And by the way, the irony with me is I'm pretty apolitical. I don't support a side because I think both sides are biased. In fact, I don't believe in opposition. Our political system is based on a 300 or 400 or 500 year old, maybe thousands of years old idea of we have to have opposition. Actually, in all generative work that I work in, we come together, and that we collapse the paradox. What we continue to do is live the paradox.
I was just going to ask one more question. Do you feel like you've made a positive impact?
Oh, I'm so lucky. I mean, that's why I do my job. I don't actually look at my bank balance ever. I think Alice might actually know this. I didn't look at my business bank account for a year. Now, you might say that's irresponsible. I actually pay people to do that. But I do look at my report and accounts every year, but I trust that the income will come based on me enjoying my work. And I enjoy my work based on purpose and impact. And so I know at the end of a session last week, three people came up and said, because of the things that I've done in this room, I think I've changed the direction of how I see the world and the direction of my life. And when people say that in a positive way, I just know that I've created a space where they can do their best work. You know, it's those notes I get years later of people. One lady again wrote me a note. She was part of a big corporate. She retired and has now gone back to the Philippines and now has built a school in the Philippines to teach young children the things that she learned in corporate America. And that's when you get fulfillment, you know, wow.
I feel like there are about 400 things here that we could have an entirely different podcast topic on. So maybe someday you'll come back and we can talk about some more of those topics. But we have taken up a lot of your time. And I know that you have currently got a very, very busy schedule. How can people find out more about you if they want to reach out, get in touch?
Look me up on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. I have websites, purposefulchange.co.uk or purposefulchange.com. And we're there and I love hanging out and having a chat. So I'd love to come back at some point. There are about 4,000 things you're right here that we could talk about.
Perfect. Amazing.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any Work is Weird moments to share, please find us on LinkedIn and let us know what they were. In the meantime, have a wonderfully weird